Hi, my name is Michael Poley, and I've never seen Buffy the Vampire Slayer. My friends are obsessed and always make jokes and references to it, and so now, 20 years later, I've been convinced to watch the show from beginning to end, one episode a week. I'm a Buffy virgin. I came up with a name for this podcast.
Oh, good.
My first name, of course, was Buffy Virgin, which I thought was good, but Travis thinks it's too sexual, and it sounds like we're going to lose our virginity every episode.
Well, just you.
Old virgins. How do you like a good excuse to hang out?
Yeah, all right.
I think it's good. It's better than virgins hanging out.
I like it because it's open, because we could completely change the scope and watch something else.
That's what I like about it.
Oh, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to watch every episode, Mike.
Oh, God, don't say
no,
that.
But if it's called a good excuse to hang out, maybe we watch something else.
Yes.
Or maybe not.
Or maybe we just watch Buffy. All right. All right, I see what you're...
But we got to have a name, and I think it's a good name. It's a good name. A good excuse to hang out.
Hey, I'm Michael. Welcome to A Good Excuse to Hang Out, a podcast where me, two friends, maybe some extra guests, we get together and we watch a show together, but every time it's Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which I've never seen. This is the second episode. We're now on to Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode 2, season 1.
And this is the Harvest episode. My name is Travis, and so I'm one of the two friends. And this is the Harvest. It season 1, episode 2, premiered March 10th, 1997. On the WB.
So thanks for the context. So another thing about us, we have all been friends since high school. So we were best friends when the show first aired. I ignored it, didn't watch it. And John and Travis, I think you both watched it later times.
A little bit later, yes.
I watched it while in high school. And we are 1 year younger than Buffy was in the show. So when she graduates high school... we are juniors, so that's our context. Pretty close, although she is in real life 4 years older than any of us, so not exactly real life similarities there, but television similarities, pretty there. So that's pretty cool.
Right, because in episode 2, she's 16 years old. It's stated
correct.
In the show.
Anyway, so it starts with action. It's a two-parter, continuing from the opener, which is Welcome to Hellmouth. And I think, Mike, you'll start with the summary of the episode.
Right, so this starts action-packed. It's like just resuming basically from a punch is how it feels. Like we're in the cemetery, we're fighting. Xander and Willow are narrowly saved by Buffy. Jesse is missing. There's a lot of drama in the opening. And then we cut to, you know, the intro, the Buffy the Vampire Slayer intro, which is a lot of fun. And something I want to pull out of the intro, because I don't know what's going to happen next. At some point, Buffy's going to become a cheerleader. Looks like, and I can't
amazing. Imagine
why she would become a cheerleader. It seems to go so against that character's philosophy. So it's like a bit of a red herring in that opening to show her in a cheerleader outfit. She kind of even does like a little pose. Anyway, I just want to point that out. That clearly looks like a really loaded joke for people just watching that. So the vampires, they have Jesse. They've taken him down to this evil lair. There's only three vampires, but apparently these three vampires that are going to bring about the end of the world as we know it. I love the lair because it's full of candles. And like, that's how you like identify when you're in a lair. I mean, this could be the Lost Boys lair. This could be a generic Castlevania boss dungeon. It's just like,
Hold on. So describe this in your never seeing a typical Buffy type lair. Like, what do you think? Like, describe the setting. Did they do a good job on the set? Did they do a good job with costume or... I'm not sure what the heck that's called. Set direction or set design.
Oh, no, I really enjoyed it because it was, like, the lighting was really motivated. So something they talk about in film is to have motivated lighting. So, like, if there's a light source, it should come from somewhere. You can't just, like, have everyone beautifully lit unless you're in a sitcom, right? Because that's, like, it's lit like it's a set.
Yeah.
So, like, the vampire leads are all lit by candlelight. I thought that was really, it was, like, a fun choice. It just seems a little absurd to have all these candles going. candles which are so timely. Versus these characters that are eternal. So it's like they must have an endless supply of candles that they have to constantly purchase. Like you'd think they would install some kind of electrical system. But, and since they are, as we learn, in the electrical system, they are in the caves. Seems like a simple wiring move or something. But they're not contractors. I get it. They're vampires.
They're not contractors. Getting back to the plot here. So, you know, we start off, Jesse's been taken. Buffy rescues Xander and Willow. Mm-hmm. And they're still in the graveyard, which, I don't know, I still think it's a really cool shot. It's just nice. It's a cool shot, at least in the graveyard, where they're just talking about they don't know where they've gone. Jesse's gone. And one of our friends has a younger brother named Jesse, and we've never made this joke about, where's Jesse? And Jesse's gone. Anyways. And so talk about this dynamic between the Master and Darla.
Oh.
Actually, I don't even think Darla has a name yet.
Darla's not really important to the Master. She's like...
She has been named, right? Yeah, she's been named. But
who's the guy that's the most important to the Master? The one? Well, we maybe get to that later.
His name is Luke.
Luke.
So Luke is obviously the powerful one, and then there's this woman whose name is Darla, and she has blonde hair, and she's always since the first episode has been in her vampire face has been shown. She hasn't really.
She's a just generic. Hungry vampire. I'm not seeing much personality from that character.
She seems to be a very weak character right now, which is just interesting.
Like, they literally, like, in the scene where they're talking about the harvest a little bit later, it's like they just cut to her as if there was an audience of vampires watching, and she just, like, smiles with her teeth out, and then they do, like, cut, like, three times. Nothing happens, but, you know, that motivates that cut, and that made me laugh out loud.
Yeah, I mean, so, yeah, you don't really understand right now, why does the Master look... Because he looks physically different from the other characters, who look a little bit more human. See?
I know why, because he's an old one.
Yes, so they did say that, okay. To me, I don't know, it's interesting, like, looking back on this episode, she's a totally, this blonde-haired vampire, totally forgettable, not powerful or interesting, really, yet, the way it's written right now in this episode. So, I don't know. It's interesting. I'm not sure that just watching the first time through, you would care about them at all. You'd care about this Luke character who at least has, like, a plan and a lot of, I don't know, the character's just written very differently. And the delivery of most of his lines are way different than Darla's. But
So Buffy saves Xander and Willow, and then they head back to hang out with Giles in the library. And that's where there's this pretty funny scene where they talk about now they know vampires exist. And, like, it's this typical Joss Whedon style, which is where you open with the, like, the obvious thing that people think of the character, then you reverse it. So it's like, Buffy's like, yeah, no, clearly not vampires. They're vampires. Or, like, there's a better joke always with Willow. She's like, I need to sit down. It's like, you are sitting down. It's like, oh, well, I guess good for me. Like, it's just this style of joke over and over again in the scene. And so we now everybody, at least our kind of core team, it looks like, has been assembled of, you know, Giles, Xander, Willow, and Buffy. And they know the secret that there are vampires. And apparently nobody else knows. We also get to see apparently Xander has a special skill. She knows how to use the internet.
Willow.
And like Giles's mind is blown by this skill.
And I gotta say, I absolutely love 1997 internet is so fast and interesting and like hackable. And when Willow like zooms in on plans, it's like amazing. Like I can't even get Google Maps today to do what Willow's doing on the sewer system tunnel plans. And everything is like this great keyboard click rather than mouse. She's not using the mouse. I don't know. I miss this alternate world where that's what the internet could have been. And I love watching old episodes because I'm like that. Anyways, I'm so nerdy like that. I love that. And so then there's the just talking about the plot where they're doing all the exposition in the library. This is where we're starting to understand the feel for the show, I think. And that will become more apparent later on. But I just want to say for the record, for everyone out there listening, this episode is the first documented instance where they talk about portals. I never realized that until I rewatched it. Portals are brought up in the second episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It's amazing. Unbelievable. And just blows my mind. So, and also in the episode, they have Hellmouth with a question mark written on a white poster board in the background, which is absolutely hilarious because they translate it from Spanish anyways. It's just absolutely ridiculous. Hellmouth question mark? And then everyone's like, oh yeah, it's a Hellmouth. It's like not a question mark situation, guys. Anyways, so portals are brought up, second episode of Buffy, there.
I love Xander's shirt in this scene. I didn't notice it. He has this amazing mushroom shirt.
Totally.
It looks like this rad psychedelic shirt.
Xander's shirts in general. Yeah.
I lusted after two outfits in this episode, and that was one of them.
Yeah.
But I like Xander in this library scene because he's this completely inadequate character, like, that has to... I think he would typically be the hero, you know, you'd expect, like, him to step in and figure out the vampire thing. But, like, he has to take a backseat to Buffy. I mean, everybody wants to do something, which is a total appropriate spot, like, response to fear. But, like, Xander has to do... Like, feels like he's totally inadequate and expresses as much, and that's kind of fun to have, like, a non-hero, wannabe hero character. I mean... It's pretty obvious what he's going to try and do later from that setup, like that he's going to try and, you know, inject himself into a heroic role. But it was just a cool setup. I like that character a lot. So after this, they leave. Buffy's been nominated basically to go save Jesse, and she says she's going to do it. Her friends have to kind of like let her do it. Like they're going to figure out how they can help in their own way. So Willow and Giles, and then Xander's not sure what he's going to do, but they're going to try and figure out how to save Jesse. So now we cut from there. We go to follow Buffy as she heads back to the cemetery, having discovered, you know, when they took a look at these maps, which they bring up these sewer maps almost instantly, you know, as a matter of like just deducing that the vampires are accessing the sewer system from the mausoleum, from the cemetery. And so there must be some access there. And that's how they were able to double back. And she wasn't able to find them in the fight scene, how they were able to escape. So she goes there. And of course, for reasons completely unknown to me why this is the setup, Angel appears. He does name himself as Angel.
Yes, he's first. It says his name.
He's wearing this great crushed velvet outfit.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't think you should go down there. Why? Why does Angel care? He's such a weird character. He's the guy that's gone there before, right?
No.
He's like this totally... No?
Yeah. No. He says for the... You know, it's never picked up. She never addresses it. He says they don't want me down there, and she never like asks why. I mean,
he says he's afraid, which also doesn't make sense for his character later. But whatever.
You just have to basically forget this ever happened. it's just be thrilled that the writing just improves for this character. It's written in really, doesn't make any sense.
Tiny amount.
No, for him at least it improves.
And did
he's like sarcastic and strange.
So here's a really nitpick. How did the vampires lock the mausoleum door, the door that's inside the mausoleum, locked with a padlock on a chain that is facing the outside? How did they lock that from inside? Or did they have some vampire lock it from the outside and then he had to go around another way? And then wouldn't he have gone through sunlight?
Angel locks him in at night.
Oh, is that his job?
Yeah.
Angel locks it, so then he stands there waiting until Buffy is there and asks him for a key, and he's like, I don't know about that lock. I don't know anything about that. Like,
I always thought, is the mausoleum door, is it something you can reach through, like, bars? I can't remember what it looks like.
Or it's like bars, and then there's a chain, and the padlock is hanging... Inside. It's hanging like a medallion on the chain, but around to Buffy's side on the other side. It's clearly locked from the outside.
Couldn't you reach your hands through the bars?
You could, but it would have to be on purpose. You'd have to clearly be doing that on purpose to make it look like it's locked from the outside, which makes no sense.
Well, I mean, think how strange it would be, John, if it was locked from the inside.
I guess that's true. For appearances?
If you're a mausoleum worker and you go into the mausoleum and it's locked from inside, you're like... Hold on, why is it locked from the inside?
Wait, is there such a thing as a mausoleum worker? Is that a thing?
Yes. Yeah, they got to maintain it. Yeah.
It doesn't look maintained. There's like leaves everywhere.
Well, I think they killed the mausoleum worker, which I guess is why you're keeping up appearances.
But also, Angel is completely useless in this episode.
Totally. He's been useless for the past two episodes.
Yeah, he comes, the only piece of information he gives is that you should turn left in the sewer, basically. And
go towards the school.
Yeah, that's it. And then, like, I mean, I'm jumping ahead, but at the end, he just, like, watches the vampires run away and just, like, stands there. Yeah. Angel is useless.
He's not even a wise man. His advice is so non-essential.
It really is.
Yeah. You definitely don't understand why this character should be important, or, you know, you feel like this is the character that should get killed off or something. You're not really feeling it. I mean, and not yet.
If he, like, he should be an older man too. He shouldn't be like a young, handsome guy that clearly like is so attractive he needs plenty of screen time. Like, it should be some hideous old, "I don't go down there. This vampire's down there." Instead, it's an attractive guy like, "Man, I wouldn't do it."
in some ways, he's almost like a typical, I mean, things aren't, can't evaluate the timeline. Anyways.
Oh, and Angel has my favorite quote from the whole episode in that scene with Angel, where she says, "Aren't you going to wish me luck?" And then, like, beat, beat, she walks in the mausoleum, beat, beat, back to him. He goes, "Good luck."
I was hoping someone would make fun of that.
That's so stupid. It's like a whisper 10 seconds later.
Yes.
Good luck.
It's like, very stupid.
It's, it's definitely, I mean, it's very, to the camera, I mean, that's all it is. You know, it is stupid, but.
Yeah. I did skip one scene, which is Buffy has a run-in with, it's the principal, again?
Principal Flutie, which is Flutie, amazing.
Where he's like, "Where do you think you're going?" You know, and she has this terrible excuse that she's getting, buying a book for Giles.
This would be my new excuse for anything. Well, I'm running an errand. I've got to buy a book for a librarian.
But I like it because, like, when she's leaving the school, she jumps over the fence in this rad, like, you know, very practical effects.
Super
jump.
Awesome. Super awesome. Which, also, the Doug, Principal Flutie, like, references, like, London or England as having the royal family and a lot of other problems. I mean, it's just totally ambiguous phrasing. His phrasing is like, "Well, that may be how they do things in England. They've got that royal family and a lot of other problems." Like, what is this guy's, what's this phrase for?
That's true. Like, Giles is totally very sensitive to the fact that he's British. And, like, apparently his Britishness is why he can't use the internet.
Yep.
Like, it makes no sense.
I would like to say that I watched this with my girlfriend an hour ago, who is both English and an academic, and she found that extremely funny.
Like, good funny or bad funny?
She definitely took it with a sense of humor, but it's the exact kind of stereotype that she finds kind of obnoxious.
Yeah. But did you tell her from 1997, so it was kind of a fresh stereotype?
I don't think it was fresh in 97.
The internet was fresh, at least.
There is nothing in this episode that is not already in Fright Night.
Oh, do we need to see Fright Night?
A wider point I want to make, maybe this is the wrong time, but, like, the wider point I want to make about this episode is that it wants to sort of mock the, cliches of the horror genre, while at the same time enacting them. And it doesn't really, I don't know, I feel like it doesn't really work. It's like, oh, Giles is boring as he explains how vampires work. But also, we totally need Giles to explain how vampires work. He's a stuffy British guy. And we're going to make fun of that, you know, that idea. But also, we're just going to totally do that idea. There's a lot of that in this episode.
That would be fun, though, to see a vampire film where they don't discuss how vampires work and heroes are woefully unprepared for vampires because they kind of they just shrug off the information and be like, "Oh, well, yeah.
Like, they keep shooting them with guns or like, "I'm going to arrest you." And it's like,
let's arrest these guys.
I mean, it's just to me, like, okay, so you have Fright Night, you have Lost Boys, you have these movies that in the 80s that are already kind of mocking the tropes and the cliches of the vampire genre. And then you have Buffy, which is doing the same thing, and it's already 10 years later from people already doing that, and I'm not sure it's bringing anything to the table. In this episode, I'm not sure it's bringing anything to the table.
Well, I think in some ways this episode's more about not necessarily mocking horror, but more maybe about switching perceptions on who should the hero be and how should a hero act. I think that's probably, in my mind, more what they're trying to do, at least for right now. But they do mock horror a little bit, like somebody dies by accident, you know, later on. But it's like in a regular horror movie, that person would have died on purpose, or I don't know. We can talk about that later on. But
yeah,
you're right. I think
so. Buffy goes into the sewer system, almost immediately joined by Xander, who is amazingly useless in this great scene where he explains all the things he should have brought but didn't. But he did bring a flashlight. She's like, "Shut it off." And then they almost immediately, after Xander shows up, they find Jesse, which is like their bait. And it's a pretty weak trap, if it's a trap, is like how you think about it, because it's like, did they just find Jesse on the ground? Like, he's pretending to be dead, and then he's chained up. So Buffy, yeah, just punches open the lock or whatever. Anyway, and then I think at some point around here we cut back to the computer lab, mm-hmm. where the girls are talking about the Bronze and how they're going back to the Bronze because there's no cover on a Friday night. And we see this great new character jump in when they're talking about the Bronze.
Yes.
First of all, they're just wailing on Willow.
Yes.
Making fun of her. Like, do you even exist? Shut up. And then Stoner Jesus kind of like ducks in from behind the computers.
I mean, talk about wishing I was an extra in Southern California in 1997.
Seriously.
So my ass.
In my notes, he's surfer disembodied head. Like...
Do you want to talk about the computer lab scene? There's a lot going on here that's fun.
Yeah, I mean, I have this as sort of like under the heading of cute technology nostalgias in the episode. So in this, you know, in the scene, Cordelia and what's her name, Travis?
Cordelia, Willow, Harmony.
And Harmony, yeah. Cordelia and Harmony.
Characters.
Cordelia and Harmony are working on a programming assignment, which I think it ought to be noted that two of the three people on this podcast are in some way involved in teaching people programming. And so this was sort of special to me, watching them try to figure out this program. I paused it and tried to figure out what programming language it was and what they were doing. And looked, zoomed in on the screen.
It was like a turtle style program trying to get something to move a direction or form a shape.
Yeah. But. So the main turtle, the idea of the turtle comes from the programming language Logo, which was a programming language designed especially for education in the 80s, actually, and by Seymour Papert, who's an important early thinker in this kind of stuff. But anyway, so when you freeze the program and you zoom in on what they're doing, they are doing a Logo type of thing, which is drawing a square. They're trying to get a program, like, write a function to draw a square. But it's not Logo, because it uses sort of a dash and then a greater than sign to make a little arrow, which is something that I know from PHP, but... It's not PHP, and it's not Logo. It's some... I don't know what it is.
You mean they're programming a Word doc that they're working on?
I don't know. Part of me thought, like, this was, like... I thought maybe Willow was doing a joke with hold deliver. But then part
yeah.
of me was like, man, maybe there really is a deliver, like, command. And, like, and then, like Willow... Because Willow's really not, like, a mean character. I mean,
right.
She never really exacts revenge, at least early on. So you think it was an intentional deliver... To delete key.
No, I think, I mean, my read of the scene, just as a surface read, I think that, yes, Willow is tricking them. But also, what text editor are they using where you can delete everything with one keystroke? That's
exactly.
not a thing.
No, it's definitely more of a TV-style programming language, much like TV, much like television, internet that they
Oh, yeah, this
used.
Isn't yeah. Mr. Robot. This is a bullshit TV
exactly.
programming.
Exactly.
Right? Where the delete key deletes the entire assignment. I like.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
So yeah. We get back to the sewers. Jesse is revealed as a vampire. He's trying to lure them into a trap. He's a vampire, and everyone's really, like, Xander's really startled by this. Like, which is fine. I think, but Buffy is, like, way less freaked out. They're able to escape. Vampires can't be exposed to sunlight. It happens to be daytime when they go down. Like, they're just missing classes, as we learn kind of later how this works out. They're able to escape. And then we cut to another scene where we learn about this strange vampire symbol that I guess we're going to associate with the master vampire, which looks kind of like a pyramidal ninja star thing.
Well, I think that was just for the ceremony of the harvest, which comes once every 100 years. And in this case, it's special because the old one, the master, he was trying to basically... bring a portal of the Hellmouth to this world to sort of end this world by letting demons come into it, and then that got screwed up by an earthquake, or as some people I think say later on, it caused the earthquake, then caused the church to collapse, and that's why he's stuck there in between worlds, as they say. So they need the vessel to drink enough blood to give the power, or the anointed one. This is the anointed one? Or is that later?
That's later.
Also,
yeah, I think
later.
That's later.
The anointed one's later. Yeah, I'm into the ones later. But
no, thank you for explaining this. I didn't understand the full, like, why this master old vampire was stuck there. I just assumed he came through a portal.
Yeah, but, so he came there a long time ago to open the portal initially, backfired, caused the earthquake, got trapped. Kane hasn't been able to get out. His minions have found him. That's all those people that are, like, doing his bidding. Those are his people. Those are his foot soldiers. Anyways, so one of them will drink his blood, and therefore, when they go above ground to feed, the blood that they drain from the humans will give him power to leave that cursed church, so that he can do his badness on the world. Won't necessarily bring the Hellmouth open or anything, but they're just trying to get him out. So a ton of exposition in that scene, which is kind of like the hallmark of the series. Mid episode, there's going to be 5 minutes in the library, Mike, where there's a lot of exposition going on.
Well, I'm looking forward to that exposition. At least we'll add some new lore in my mind about these characters. Like, I know the Slayer stuff, vampire stuff. This feels like about as far in as most movies get in. You know, it's a vampire stuff, so it's all very familiar territory. So from here, we cut to the Bronze. There's like things are happening at the Bronze. Did I miss a scene?
No, I think I would just go back to where Luke, that the sort of big bad vampire.
Oh yeah, this is a long scene that was pretty boring.
Yeah, it's pretty boring. Long. The only thing that's interesting is like when Luke is drinking the master's blood, it's kind of sexual. It's not overly sexual.
It's pretty sexual.
It's fairly sexual for a television. You know, they make these jokes about he's risen. There's a lot of like very veiled, like sort of sexual tumescent jokes about him being risen and stuff. So I mean, that's pretty funny.
I mean, but I think the problem is again, there's nothing being brought to the table, right? I mean, we like in vampire fiction up to this point in the '90s, we've established that we're used to the idea that vampires are a way of talking about sexuality. We have, you know, Anne Rice already exists. We've had Interview with a Vampire. We've had lots of things where vampires are a proxy for talking about sexuality. And in that scene where Luke is sucking on the vampire on the master's wrist, and Luke's got his tight clothes on, it's clearly sexual, but also I don't feel like the show has anything to say about that. It's just sort of, that's how we do vampires now because it's the '90s. And so it just feels like very by the numbers.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm not disappointed in the scene. It's certainly like it's trying to like, you know, I guess continue that tradition. I think vampires have always been sort of sexual, but it's
well, if you had to write a scene where like one vampire is going to work his way in the world through another vampire drinking their blood, totally appropriate, didn't have an issue with that, seemed like just typical stock vampire stuff.
But yeah, I that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, to you it's not remarkable. I think to me, the what was remarkable was that they're stupid vampires. And that scene right before then, one of the vampires gets killed because he's just dumb. He's a dumb guy, so he gets killed. I think that was like the new thing that bring to the table. Like, vampires aren't all smooth and cool and like charismatic. There are dumb vampires, and they can suck. And then other vampires know it, and they just kill them because they're like, these guys are dead weight, literally. All right, so then we go to the Bronze.
Yes, the Bronze. And this is like my favorite scene in the episode because the Bronze is totally, this is like, this feels like real, like they wrote the playbook on teen supernatural drama in this scene at the Bronze.
Good, I think that's the compliment, where, I don't know.
Where we, you know, we cut in and like, oh gosh, what's the name of the kind of like, the character that was just making fun in the computer lab,
Willow.
Not Willow.
Chris McCarthy.
Chris's character,
aka Cordelia. So
Cordelia. So this is where she starts with this crazy rant about how you like. Well, it's not crazy. It's just like so superficial. It's like, I don't want the most expensive in the store because it's the most expensive. I want it because it costs more. And you're like, wow, this is this great vapid character telling you why they're vapid in like in a defensible, somewhat defensible way, but still like really insane. And then she tells her friend to shut up even though she's the only one talking. It's like it's great. It made me smile through this whole little spiel, even though it's really vapid. It's
I mean, absolutely. Cordelia's painted in this horrible light.
Oh, this character's horrible in this episode.
But then you also realize later on in the same episode that she is human and also a victim too. So anyways, I don't know what they're trying to say, but to me they're just painting vapid human, but still a human, still worth saving, still a bit.
Well, the fun inversion in this scene is that she's super vapid, and then she goes into the spiel about how even like how Jesse was acting like such a like a dog, like falling around, and
well,
then immediately, like she's like, "Oh, it's my favorite song on dance floor." Completely generic alt rock, love it, very 90s. That's very nostalgic. And she gets off the dance floor, and then Jesse, now in vampire mode, is just staring her down, not saying anything, and like that's now he's super attractive to her, and she can't control it. And like that's so that was like this. And then when we cut from there to the vampires walking in slow motion to the club, I'm like, man, this is some teen drama playbook. Like, I don't know what this play is of like kid becomes vampire. Now he's no longer a nerd. Everything's inverted. Now he's like a sexual predator that that
he
has control. And like that simple inversion is like that was fun to see that, even though it's like the characters are so reprehensible.
If we can wait a minute, I can explain why that character is totally different now. Because Giles says later that thing that when Xander tries to say he's going to save Jesse, he goes, "That thing that looks like your friend is not your friend. That's a demon who killed your friend." And so when you say this guy is totally different, in this world it makes sense that he's different. He is not that character. Jesse is dead. He is a demon inside Jesse's body. And that's where that character kind of goes way different, way confident, predatory, because it's not a human anymore. Anyways, that's this world. That's this world.
My read of that scene was a little less charitable. I felt like what was happening there is, you know, so we have a scene with Cordelia, which doesn't shed more light on Cordelia's character. It's a totally reinforcing the negative aspects of Cordelia's character for that point. She's shallow. She's mean to her friends. She's bitchy. We don't like her, right? It's all the things we hate about her are reinforced. And they don't even need to be reinforced because it's not like we've had a ton of information contrary to that. It's mostly been that, right?
It's all been negative.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. And so we have a scene just to remind us, oh yeah, by the way, you hate this lady. And then we have Jesse. We have the scene with Jesse, which is super rapey, right? And before he even says anything, she's looking at him. And then as soon as he says, shut up, she's on board. Where it's just like, yeah, she's a bitch, but what she really wants is for somebody to take control of her. You know, and it's,
I don't like this. I don't like the read on women at all. But
yeah.
Like the scene inversion is really powerful. Like watching that, even though it's vapid 90s stuff, that was like, my mind was just like in overdrive watching that scene. Like I was a little surprised that they went that far with that scene.
There was an opportunity here to do the scene differently. And maybe, I mean, there's always a danger in these kinds of discussions to just like, oh, let's rewrite this show that's 20 years old or whatever. There's an opportunity here to challenge the Revenge of the Nerds narrative where, you know, Jesse feels like because he was ignored by this kind of woman that he has a right to own this kind of woman. There's an opportunity here to point out how that's actually a fucked up attitude. And what happens instead is that we see Cordelia as, oh, that's what she wanted all along.
Yeah, but again, this isn't Jesse the character. This is I don't know. I stick by the premise of the show, which is this is a demon who has the memories of, and Mike, I'm sorry, this wasn't ever explained. This is a demon that has the memories of the person that was killed. That's
but it's an extension
within the canon. Within the canon, that's exactly what happened.
But it's an extension of what happens in the first episode. In the first episode, Jesse is interested in Cordelia.
He's turned down by her.
He's frustrated, and so therefore, it's a comeuppance when he, you know, I definitely think in the second episode, it feels to some extent like a comeuppance when he finally gains his vampire confidence. And sure, he's officially the evil character. I get that, but like,
We also have to be okay with. Like, this show is very, like, not sure how it... I mean, it wants to control how we feel about Jesse. And, like, because Jesse's going to die in this episode, right? And, like, that's not cool for these guys. Like, Jesse was their best friend, one of their best friends in the first episode. And it's like, we have to totally character assassinate Jesse so that it's okay to kill him. And, like even the way they kill Jesse in the next scene, basically, is, like... very much like no one's taking responsibility for his death. It's just like he became a vampire. Like it, maybe I'm cutting ahead too far, but you know, where Xander kills Jesse, it's like he's got the stake. He doesn't want to kill his friend, But someone bumps Jesse into the stake, kills him. So it's like, oh, you have no responsibility, basically, for killing your friend.
So, Mike, I want to know for you, because, you know, I think there's a narrative that goes on about these first couple episodes that is, you know, what an innovative thing Joss Whedon was doing by making it appear that Jesse was going to be a regular on the show, but it turns out that he gets killed. For you, was Jesse's death surprising?
I actually thought they were going to rescue Jesse. I was surprised that the vampire like reversal, where it's like he's a vampire, that was a little. I was maybe a little sad. I thought they were going to try and figure something out, and like when I saw when Xander like when they get back to the library. And Xander just kicks a trash can, like he's angry at the world, and then like basically gives his like you know what do they call it gallows humor. You know, clearly all these characters have PTSD together, gallows humor kind of response. But I can't remember what he said about it. It's like I really identified with Xander strongly when Jesse turns and you're kind of like you're there like Buffy's already moved on, Giles has already moved on, but Xander and Willow are kind of like new to this, and it makes me really empathize with their characters, because like Xander doesn't want to kill his friend, you know, and he still thinks his friend is there, even though like I guess canonically like a demon and he's already dead, don't worry about it, let's move on.
And again, as I would say that this is the only thing that's new with the vampires. I can't remember. But generally in the vampire, you know, lore or whatever it came before this, it was more like the person who became a vampire didn't stop being that person. There wasn't the whole soul. We don't have time to go into the soul discussion here. But generally in the past, like, since someone became a vampire, it was kind of like that same person simply became, you know, immortal or was killed by sunlight. It's not like their core person got changed a whole ton. This is the show that came along that tried to say maybe something a little bit different, that if you're turned into a vampire, your soul leaves your body, you are not that same person, but the demon that resides in that person now has your memory. So I don't know. So I think that was a new thing. And Giles like kind of says it really quick. I don't think it really registers with the audience like that well.
No, it doesn't.
Because we're so used to the opposite, which is just, well, this person's a vampire now, but it's still Jesse. He's just a vampire.
I don't know. For me, I just... Jesse's death, and I've seen this I don't know how many times.
20 times.
But Jesse's death feels really shallow to me, because I think that the statement the show is trying to make is that this is not Star Trek. We don't have red shirts, people who are... You know, we don't have disposable characters that deaths count, that this is... You know, Jesse's a real person. But then when he dies, he's not actually grieved. It doesn't... There's no follow-through. He's... The last scene is on a very up note, and there's really
That last scene is really crazy.
Well, let's hold on. I think we still have to talk about the rest of the nightclub scene.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Go ahead.
Let's talk about the.
Yeah. So I mean, for me, I think I've said my piece about what it takes to become a vampire a little bit so far. But what I have to say is that what I love about this fight scene in the bronze, I'm not going to mention most of what I was going to talk about, but. You know, the reality is, like, there's a huge body count in the bronze. I didn't even keep track of how many innocent people died, so that's kind of bizarre. And two, there's wood everywhere in the bronze, which is great. There's wood, like, on chairs. There's a pool cue. You know, I mean, it's very awesome, and I love it. And, you know, there's jokes about sunrises and, like, keeping track of time. I mean, I think that's kind of all a little bit fresh. Not like, I think all of those elements are a little bit fresh, or a little bit fun at least. You know, who's cracking a joke about sunrise and knowing what time of the day it is? And, you know, I don't know. I think I certainly enjoyed all that aspect. It's all kind of campy and strange, and you're just looking at these piles of wood thinking, oh, thank God, things are going to be all right. She's going to, I don't know. Anyway, so this fight scene in the bronze to me is enjoyable. For these little bits that they throw in, but for
I like it because it's supposed to be the end of the world, but it's so like it's so understated. I mean, Luke has this ostentatious kind of like monologue where he's like, "Ladies and gentlemen, things are going to be just fine, except they will be completely not fine." Like it's this really stupid speech, and it goes on way too long. But basically saying that everybody's going to murder them, and like I. this is some old-timey thing. Like, you would never see a terrorist attack conducted like this. I mean, and also with so few vampires, I think it's like three vampires total are doing this whole attack.
In some ways, you can tell that Luke's, like, old school. Like, he's not, you know, as he jokes about, you know, there's a reference to him being, attacked by a Slayer in Madrid in the 1800s, so... It's also like the old campy thing. And guess what? It doesn't
matter. So campy.
It's like, very campy.
How long does he wait to bite into Buffy's neck? He literally has to tell her the reason for why he's doing it.
Right.
He's like, I've always wanted to taste blood like this. He drops everything he's doing. Also, apparently Slayer blood is the best.
It is the best.
It's like you're about to like enjoy, I won't say virgin, but you got to enjoy a Cordelia blood. And it's like, oh, wait, Buffy's here. Throw her to the side. I gotta get that.
Well, I'm glad that it comes through.
Interesting note. Darla makes two statements about vampire blood preferences in this episode. One is that Jesse's blood is preferential because he's a virgin. He's pure.
Yes, I was going to talk about that.
And the other one is that Cordelia's blood is preferential because she's pretty.
Yes.
So pretty and virgin. Also, those are the things we like. I don't know.
No. It's
also important that you get the first taste. That old vampire is very pissed that he didn't get to drink Jesse's blood first.
Because there's less blood there. It's just that.
No,
that
he is like, it's like a smackdown.
Well, you wouldn't.
No,
would you want a taco with a bite taken out of it?
That's less taco. That's more of a quantity than a quality.
I don't know. It's a quality thing, too. I don't think I want... I mean, the fact that, like, if somebody brought me a slightly smaller taco, I'd be cool with that. But if somebody brings me a large taco with a bite taken out of it, that's kind of fucked up.
That's what I'm saying. It's a quantity issue. It's not going to say quality.
No, it's a quality issue.
No, it's a quantity and quality issue,
it's
I guess.
Mostly a quality issue. It's mostly you don't want to put your mouth where someone else's mouth was.
Oh, that was the one. That's the thing. It's not the biting and all the blood sucking. That's... But it's the mouth that was there first.
It's somebody else's scraps, like he says. It's not, I don't know, anyway. It doesn't make you feel powerful.
The best part of this, though, is like the scene ends, Buffy is able to confuse Luke with his fake sunrise gag. It's just a bright light. He's such an idiot. I feel like this is a gag that's probably been used a million times in vampire movies.
No.
It hasn't? But I love when it cuts from... like basically a pile of bodies. I think Xander, someone says this. Xander says, nothing's ever going to be the same. It's basically cut to sunny day, guy playing hacky sack. I love that. I was thinking when I was looking at that, I was like, if you can cut to a sunny day guy playing hacky sack after any tragedy, and it's going to be funny. It's like, it could be Pearl Harbor, and it's like, man, nothing's ever going to be the same. And it's like, meanwhile, hacky sack, sunny day.
That's a good point. That you're right. That is a good cut.
So I mean, I've got to say, like, so the last, to me, like, the best episode, like, I think of Buffy ever. The best ending is this episode. There's nothing that tops like the emotional turmoil and yet the hopefulness of this episode, where like they've all just met, they've gone through this horrible thing, they've met each other, and at the end of the episode, they're so hopeful. Like, despite this horrible thing, I mean, there are like 6 or 7 people that died the previous night. Their friend died, you know, and then they're just so hopeful and they're making jokes. And Giles has this great line, you know, the earth is doomed. Like, when, you know, and he's not really serious. He's more like just being British, maybe. I'm not sure if I'm using that phrase correctly, but, you know, he's just more just being British. And it's like, to me, this is actually, if I had to pick all the episodes of all the Buffy. Of all the Buffy, you know, seasons, this is the best ending to any single episode.
I disagree.
I absolutely.
This is the simple sitcom ending. This feels like we're wrapping a bow, and then it's
correct.
The next monster
we need,
of the week next week.
We need to reset. Is what it feels like.
Well, I guess it'll be that same old one next week with a new minion. Maybe Darla will be the minion next week.
But no, this ending feels like a total like reset. This could have happened on The Simpsons. Like, this was like, like we need to wrap up everything that happened so that we can start over with the next episode.
They don't wrap up anything, though.
But I mean, the thing that I feel like, and I don't want to jump the timeline. I'm going to have to a little bit. But like the thing that Joss Whedon is... It's a joke now. The thing that Joss Whedon is known for is communicating this idea of sudden, unexpected death and what the effect that has on people and the way that even alters your sense of reality. And then Jesse dies, and it's one scene of kicking a trash can, and we're done. And I feel like for everything that that experiment in episodic television purports to be. Like, can we treat a throwaway character like he's a real character? Can we treat a red shirt like he actually has some emotional import to everyone else? And in the end, it's like, no, we can't, because, you know, Jesse dies. You know, Mike, you're right. We have this sort of character assassination of him so that we don't really feel that bad that he's dead. And, you know, Xander has one scene where he's upset about it, and everybody else is fine, and Xander's fine in the end. And the, that last scene is in a way, it's kind of a mission statement for the show. Like, hey, we're going to have a lot of different monsters. Looking forward to that.
They're at a, like, yeah, like you could, I mean, the Simpsons version of this, right, would be like, you'd have some supernatural Giles-like character saying, like, well, we are, you know, like, you know, Bart's like, or Homer, like, oh, so glad we got on that one. And it's like, well, we're at the transvergence of the Hellmouth, which means that umpteen, you know, monsters will probably arrive shortly and end the world as we know it. And Homer would be like, yeah, but that's next week.
Exactly. And it just doesn't feel like, I mean, and Jesse is, literally never brought up again.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm trying to think.
There's no funerals.
I don't mean to spoil that for you, but I'm pretty sure he's never brought up again.
There's no funerals for any of those characters, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'll be all by myself when I'm talking about the ending. I mean, I still like it. I think mostly because it doesn't try to do too much, and it doesn't try to overanalyze the situation, which I think you guys think maybe it's more just ignoring everything that happened. I would agree that it's not. The killing of Jesse would be a lot better long term if they ever brought it up again, John.
Right.
I feel like Jesse's character wasn't even that interesting to start with, and it was only in the sense that no one's ever killed, you know, in the late 90s, you know, inconsequential, you know, TV characters didn't just get killed during the television show. To me, that was the only thing that was really different. There's different characters, obviously, and we won't jump the timeline, but you'll know what I mean when I say, at another time when a character dies, has a huge significance, and that's because
right.
They learned from this. They learned
right.
from this. This was, and then, Mike, what I'm trying to tell you is that these first episodes, they are just such a great learning experience for the writers and the actors. And when you look back, you won't really necessarily think that they're all that impressive,
right.
Even though they have really impressive pieces. But this was incredible groundwork that was done so that really interesting stuff happens later.
Well,
right.
I mean, I like this episode a lot. I mean, I like that, you know, Jesse gets killed and, like, there's not a lot of melodrama about it. It's like, this sucks,
right.
Life sucks. Like, Xander kicks a trash can. Like, we're powerless to stop this from happening. But he's already felt powerless, so it's a reminder of his powerlessness. So, I mean, I think he's the strongest and most interesting character in this show.
So, Mike, I want to hear what your thought is on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the series, after these two episodes. What you liked, what you didn't like, overall how you feel about it, and what your predictions are.
Well, I think I've talked a lot about what I like and don't like about it. I really like Xander. It's my favorite character so far. I thought Jesse was going to last longer than he did, so that was a surprise for me. And you guys are telling me he doesn't come back, so, I mean,
Sorry.
Just evaporates, which is just what
he's
happens.
He's dust, brother.
Well, that doesn't mean he's gone.
Well,
they
wow.
could at least talk oh, about maybe. Him. They could at least be like, "Remember that best friend I had?" Like,
you know, wow. Let's all remember this. Mike saw Vampire Go to Dust. And
well,
says
you guys.
That, no, hold on. This is actually really important. If anyone ever listens to this, Mike in this episode in this podcast says, "Just because a vampire goes to dust doesn't mean he's done." That's great. That's a prediction in and of itself, my friend. So
that's
let me
true.
Be more specific
Good
when
point.
I ask you about what you liked about this. Okay, so I think I was being too broad. First off. Did you think it was? What did you think of the writing? Then I'll ask you, what did you think of the actors? And then what did you think of the overall production?
Mm-hmm. So the writing, writing is like I'm understanding now the style of Whedon, which is the Whedon inversion, which is like you state the scene, and then you just do a quick reversal. Everything is based on a reversal of expectations. Which is a fun format, but it feels very campy. Even scenes that are loaded with exposition, I mean, everything feels campy. Like, exposition scenes in particular feel the campiest in that inversion format. Action scenes, I think, are better for an inversion, but exposition scenes are campy. They make the high school scenes really fun, because there's a lot of inversions in those dialogue as well. I feel like...
I feel like the dialogue is quick, like it's not clunky.
It is a little clunky because, like, the.
What do you think is the where is it clunkiest? Is it the exposition with the Hellmouth and the?
Yeah, well, the vampires are the worst characters. I don't care about the vampires
so
at
their
all.
Dialogue is, okay.
Their dialogue is terrible. I don't know why they're overwritten to be these old timey, out of touch with reality characters, but like they are boring. And so it's like when they die, you're like, good, glad this guy got rid of this guy.
Yeah.
Like, I only care about the students. I care about the friends, and they're cool. But like, and like, I'm interested in Cordelia and these other characters. I do not care about the vampires. As soon as you become a vampire, you become a boring character. That's what happens to Jesse.
So far.
As soon as it becomes boring, you become a boring rapist, basically. A bloodthirsty rapist when you become a vampire.
Not only are you a rapist, but you're boring. You're going to be a rapist. The least you could do is be interesting.
And a bloodthirsty one, which is true. Literally bloodthirsty. Well, how about the actors? You know, I'm going to say, I guess tell me what you think of their raw acting ability now. I'm sorry. These are specifics. This is the reason the podcast was created. I want to know what you think.
It's important to get this now before later.
No, it's important to say, what do you think their raw capabilities of acting are versus the material they're given and versus their direction that they're given? So raw acting abilities, let's go by number one. Let's go by play because it's the only way it's going to work. So Sarah Michelle Gellar.
She's great. She's smart enough to take this character in a direction that's beyond the writing. Like, it's pretty clear that she's a great choice. Like, she's really smart, really a great anchor for the show.
Okay, so you believe in her. Okay, so then let's talk about Nicholas Brendon.
Xander.
No,
he's my favorite character. Fantastic actor. You really relate to that character.
So you see talent already in that character.
Kicking the garbage can after his friend died is like, that's the deal for me. I like that character a lot.
All right, Willow.
Liked him in the first episode, but the first episode he was like total like...
too eager, too horndog.
Horndog, and it was annoying. This episode, there were some stakes for him because he's trying to find his friend and his impotence and like not being able to do anything. Like, I really like that. And then his complete failure to save his friend. Love that. And then he kills his friend. Like, that's just such an epic fail on his part. And then of course, like at the end, he's kind of like, well, this is just how my life is. Like, he has no power over anything. And it's like an awesome arc for that character.
Next character, Anthony Stewart Head, a.k.a. Giles. What do you feel about him as a talent?
He's okay. He's not that great.
He's not wowing you with any...
I mean, he's just... It's like Doc on Back to the Future. There's important information I need to tell you. No, not yet. It's too soon. Like, it's just... His character's really boring. He's an exposition character. Yeah. Doesn't add a lot.
So we know David Boreanaz, you're not hot on. Not like Angel. And then, of course, then there's Allison Hannigan, Willow.
She's at least a little bit interesting. She's very funny, very dry character, the way she plays the jokes and stuff. So dry, in fact, you can't tell if she knows that she's telling a joke. Like when that deliver one
right.
is so dry, you don't know if she knows that she is being mean. Like, and that's just weird. That's like that ambiguity. Like maybe it's charming, but it's also a little off. And that makes the character a little interesting, but it's also like she's clearly like got a lot of room to grow in that character and to figure out where the jokes are. Like that. You shouldn't be confused whether or not something's a joke, as confused as you are with her character.
So,
like, she plays it a little too airheaded sometimes, like, at least the delivery, like, it's just so dry. Which, I don't know, it's good comic performance, but it's off when you juxtapose with a character like Cordelia. I don't know,
I guess
Cordelia, that character's terrible. She's a terrible actress.
Hold on, we'll get to this second. I guess my feeling with Allison Hannigan is that she has this incredibly expressive affect. I guess you haven't really seen a lot of it yet, but like when she's delivering her lines or when she's upset or sad, it's like just written all over her face. Which I hope that comes through. And the second thing you haven't really heard yet is she has this incredible scream. Actually, Joss Whedon loves the way that she screams. He's talked about this before. So anyway, to him, when she screams, it's like the most like sad, terrifying thing. So we'll hear her scream a lot more, but anyway, so there's like a whole special thing about when he hears Allison scream, it's like, it makes him so sad and upset and strange. So she'll scream a lot in the future. Like, he ended up liking that. So anyways, so the next one is Cordelia Chase, a.k.a.
Such a waste. That's too bad. She's a terrible actress. Anyway.
So you actually think her raw talent is bad? I'm not asking about the character. I'm asking about the raw talent of her right now.
I mean, that's the opposite of what you said last episode, Mike.
Oh, yeah. Is it? Did I say I really liked her?
Yeah, you said last you thought she was one of the funnier parts of it last time.
Like she was so she did the same thing this episode. It was really like it made me laugh because it was so it was such.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about the subject matter, what they say. I'm just saying like, do you think this person is a talented actor or actress? I mean, do you think they have talent? Because there's some duds like that Jesse character. I'm not convinced even if he had better material, he would be a much better actor. He ended up being an actor much later on in this in. He's one of the main actors on this sci-fi show, Warehouse 13, I think. Okay. He ended up being a real actor, but here I don't think he knew his line. It didn't seem like he was really a great actor in this episode, no matter what. Even if he had really poor, boring.
Well, I'm prepared to be amazed by Charisma Carpenter, but the first episode it was what was like felt really fresh. Now it doesn't feel as fresh in the second episode.
So the character's like, not just
character
fresh
didn't
for you. Okay.
Character didn't go through any progression or changes.
Right.
Like, and I don't. And she, so maybe the writing is like a stall out for her.
Right.
But she's basically just another victim. Like she's not an interesting character. It's like, cool, we're gonna play off this character, and this is a person that will be raped and victimized. Like I anticipate. So this is my. I want to do the predictions part. I just anticipate terrible things happening to Charisma's character because we already hate her, like her attitude and stuff. Like we felt a little bit empathy for her at the end of that episode because of her near rape by Jesse. But like, prediction one: terrible things will happen to Charisma Carpenter. Will she survive season one? I don't know how brutal Joss Whedon is.
That's true.
I feel like he could kill her off. Like. With a dalliance with a vampire, because she is weak to vampires, as we've learned. So, like, very easy for a vampire to be like, approach her and do his silent, creepy thing, and she'll be, you know, living in the sewers, another vampire. In which case, if she's a vampire opponent, that's kind of a cool, interesting thing, and I don't know how that would play out, how they would use that. Obviously, anticipate the Hellmouth opening again and more demons appearing, because right now we only have the two, Darla and the old one. Which is not enough vampires. We need a lot more vampires for this to work. So that Hellmouth better open up fast.
A lot more bad guys.
More bad guys have to appear. Because right now, no, there's just the old one, and that's like, you know what, he's going to make Darla do his bidding again. That's not very interesting. So we'll need some more villains to appear for this to really work. I think Buffy's mom has to get involved, because that's not interesting otherwise. We keep seeing her. So like, either she gets kidnapped, or she has to have some awareness, but then... But in such a way that she doesn't have to acknowledge the existence of the vampire world. Apparently, she has to live in the adult world that's not the vampire world. So, like, just anticipating some kind of situation with Mom. I think we'll see Willow and Xander become an item. Maybe not at the end of the season. I don't know how fast this kind of stuff can happen. But, like, they look like they have to get together, sexually. That needs to happen. We're going to go back to the Bronze. Wow. There will be no changes to the Bronze security situation. The Bronze is apparently like where every alt-rock band that Whedon can find in Los Angeles is going to walk through there. I'm expecting to see a couple named bands, maybe Toad the Wet Sprocket.
There is a named band.
Come through for the Bronze.
There are a few named bands.
I'm expecting more students to die and no one to care. I'm expecting people to walk into classrooms. I'm expecting to see a teacher inversion, that one of Buffy's teachers will be a vampire, because that seems like an easy gag to play that fits within the high school world. I'm not anticipating Flutie to make any direct changes. Flutie's going to stay on the same situation, Buffy being unforgiving and kind of concerned, but always threatening her. It sounds like from you guys that we're going to hear a lot more about vampire lore. Maybe about the Spanish, the Spanish history where this earthquake took place. Probably hear more lore about that. The Willow and Giles is going to become more of a thing. I'm sorry, Willow and Giles more of a thing. I don't know if this show does werewolves, but like, I don't know how, she is the vampire slayer, but like, I think they need some other kinds of monsters to make this work. Like, we've already kind of seen this old one vampire, so we need some fresher takes on vampires, and maybe that's Angel, but, like, I think I'm tired already of the 80s formula that they're borrowing from, so I need to see some fresher vampires in this next few episodes, and I don't know what those look like. So, they don't have the face transformation, so they just look like regular people, which would be awesome, or... I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know how, like, what Whedon's wheelhouse is as far as, like, types of characters.
So I want to ask you, Mike. So you mentioned that you were genuinely surprised by Jesse's death.
I mean, you saw it coming from him, from the setup, but, like, I didn't... The death doesn't... I don't know how permanent death is in this universe.
Right.
And I didn't think he was going to get killed.
So this is a TV show that kind of is known... I don't think I'm spoiling anything by saying this is a TV show that's known for eliciting emotions, right?
Yeah.
Is that happening for you on any level? Are you feeling your... Do you have your feels field?
Oh, just that moment I mentioned where Xander kicks the can. Yeah. I was like... I felt that emotion before.
Right.
Powerless to stop something terrible from happening. That's already happened.
Right.
But I didn't feel anything when he killed his friend. I was like, you've already kind of... His friend's already dead. I already moved on, like, from his vampire transformation. I mean, he's a different character, so I just anticipated something else happening after that.
Right. Like, I'm super excited to continue this project and see if that happens for you over time. Because, you know, I don't know if it's pure nostalgia that makes me have Buffy feelings or if it's something a little more authentic. I don't know. And I think it'd be interesting to see if it ever builds that for you or if it maybe just doesn't.
I mean, I'm sure it will. Just the, like, inevitability of watching the same thing for so long. Like,
right.
That feels like how this show wins. It's like, I will just keep watching it and then I will like it. But at this point, I could turn it off and walk away. But
right.
I will continue to watch this show. Because
as
you're
a
both
favor.
Extremely, as a favor. Well, you're both excited about it. And it's crazy to how many details that can be discussed and drawn out of a 40-minute television show. Thanks for listening. Reach out to us at BuffyVirgin.com in the comments section to talk more about Buffy. Anyway, thanks so much. Have a great week.